أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن. ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد. لبيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ومن الناس من يعبد الله على حرف فإن أصابهم خير اطمأن به وأن أصابتهم فتنة انقلب على وجهه خسر الدنيا والآخرة ذلك هو الخسران المبين. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد.
اللهم صل على
The concept of absolute submission has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 3. The attempt from day number 1 has been to introduce the idea of taslim. And taslim mutlaq, meaning absolute submission. We submit to Allah, no doubt, but sometimes people like me, we submit with conditions. That so long as A, B, and C are happening, I'll submit to you. The moment things get a little bit this way, then I'll submit to somebody else. And yesterday we looked at two very important verses from the Quran and really presented the idea that Allah, time and time again, through His verses, is almost telling us, what more do I need to do for you now to understand and to submit to me? What haven't I done for you? That you are now going to A, B, and C, but you're not going to me. And remember the verse of the fly we talked about yesterday. And then, of course, at the end, we talked a little bit about the concept and the idea of love and identifying who your true love is. And the problem lies when we identify a false love to be a true love, and we chase that love and chase that love in the dunya. We attain that love only to be disappointed. And we expected from this love what it couldn't give us. In today's discussion, we will again examine a verse from Surah Hajj. Yesterday we looked at a verse from that same Surah 73. Today it will be Surah Hajj, ayat number 11. And I tell you, sometimes you look at certain verses from the Quran and you wonder, was that verse revealed for us today or was it revealed for somebody else? When I was learning a little bit about the Quran in the Hawza, I remember one of the things that they really brought home to us was that the Quran is a miracle. Now, a lot of our youth ask us, how do we claim it's a miracle? We also say that it's the only miracle given to any prophet that lasts today. You know that every miracle given to every other prophet was for that era and that zaman. When the Prophet left, the miracle left with it. Be it Musa's serpent or Nabi Isa's ability to give life to the dead. But this was the one miracle of the Holy Prophet that is a miracle even to today. And one of the reasons, while there are many, is because the subject in which some of the verses are talking about are universal throughout every era and every zaman. So the more you study the Qur'an, the more you realize that there are verses that are talking directly to us today. Almost as if, like I said before, almost as if it was revealed for us today. And this is one of those verses that I came across. And while I'm here, let me give a little bit of a pointer about the Quran itself. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajjal farajahu.
A lot of us, a lot of our youth, a lot of your children, and this is all based on talks that I've had over the past few years here locally in Toronto and during my travel, they're looking for a fix, they're looking for a quick solution. What can I do to, you know, make this better and make that better? They're looking for an overnight pill to wake up the next morning, everything is like magic gone. Or people believe that sometimes my house, you know, there's jinn in it, or somebody has, you know, done some sort of nazar on it, and you know, it seems there's a lot of bad luck in my house, and there's no sukoon, it's been on in my house. And what can I do, of course, to do that? And when I tell them that the best remedy for all of these things is the Quran, they say, yeah, I know, but what else do you have? And you underestimate the power of the Quran. And I wish we had more time to talk about it. It's a different topic altogether, but truly, if there is somebody who's listening to me right now who is really struggling with whatever they're going through, and they feel like no matter what I try, this black cloud won't leave me, then do your best to be reconnected with the Quran. If that means you recite 10 verses a day, then 10 verses a day. I had one teacher in the Hausa, and he told me of his teacher. And he said to us that we get caught up in these traps of the Quran sometimes. So we think that it's a very long process to read the Quran. Because we're told that, you know, make sure that you read it with translation and then understand what you're reading, and then before you know it now, you know, you have to go through a whole half an hour process for 5 verses, and we don't have that kind of time nowadays. On top of that, these young guys will tell you these translations are very weird, Mawlana. Dying and thy and thou and thus, I have no idea what we're talking about. And on top of that, we're told, these are young guys now, even if the translation makes sense, you're not a mufassir, right? You can't just pick up the Quran and start understanding it. So all these hurdles and traps are in front of us, so they say, forget it. Until someone dies or someone gets married, the Quran remains on the shelf. And my teacher said these are all satanic and shaitani traps, nothing else. He said that, yes, I will give you the fact that our time, especially here in the West, is very, very limited. For those who have lived a little bit of life beyond the West, you know that this is the only area in the world that lives like this, the constant rat race. The constant, I mean, even to carve out time to come here for 1 hour majlis or 2 hour majlis is very difficult. Especially on weeknights. I had the honor of living for 10 years in Iran, and that was the most balanced life I've ever seen. We would all be home by noon, me, my daughter, and my wife. Back from school, back from her own house. My wife also went to the house. All three of us back home by noon. We would spend time together, have lunch together, pray salat by jamaat together, even nap for about an hour, can you imagine? And then go back out at 4 p.m. and come back home by 6, and that's our day. We will start at 7 a.m., no doubt, just like all of you do. But that middle portion was such a balance. And I found myself having more time to do a lot of things that we couldn't do here. The biggest struggle I had in adjusting to my life in Qom was I had too much time. I'm sitting there just kind of, okay, what do I do now? House is clean and the kitchen is clean and we're fed and the kids asleep. Now what do we do? Here it's just boom, boom, constant, especially Toronto. It's a zoo sometimes, this city. Someone's not dying, and someone's giving birth, and someone's having this barsi and that soyam and this bismillah and that shavlima, and you just—it's constant. Our weekends are not our weekends anymore; someone else's. And so, in all of that, now someone like me is saying, "Oh, by the way, read the Quran." I don't have time for you. I'm sorry. He says, "My ustad, very important." He says that my ustad, meaning his ustad, would use moments that were not scheduled for the Quran, and he gave me an example. He said that my teacher had 2 classes a week in Tehran, and the bus ride from Qom to Tehran was an hour and a half tops. He said he would spend that bus ride with the Quran. He said, sometimes you're in a taxi. He's talking about stuff. Sometimes you're in a taxi from where you live to the Haram. It's a 10-minute drive. And you can look outside. You can talk to the taxi guy about, you know, Apple prices and prices of gas and oil and sanctions, whatever you want to talk about. Or you can open up one. And those five-minute drive is, let's say, 4 or 5 verses. You're carving timeouts now. You're using unscheduled time to be productive. Some of you use the GO train. Some of you commute on the subway. Some of you are driven, let's say, you're carpool, whatever the case, or you're on school buses. You have that moment. In that moment, open up an app. Now it's on your fingertips, right? 5 verses I'm asking you for. Not a whole juz, nothing, but 5 verses, 5 verses. And you don't have to worry about translation. Just read the Arabic. We don't understand sometimes the power of the Arabic language itself on our hearts. Let me share with you one story and then we move on. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Is the echo okay? You guys can hear me okay? Ashur Ma, you okay? The echo is not too much?
Not too much.
Okay, alright, okay. So a very quick story, then we'll get to the actual verse. Verse 11 of Surah Hajj, inshallah. We'll expand on that tonight. A very quick story about the Qur'an. I really want all of us now to begin to introduce ourselves to the Qur'an again. It's a shame that we who believe in Thaqalain have taken the Ahl al-Bayt and left the Qur'an. Right? If we are angry at our Sunni brothers for leaving the Ahl al-Bayt, then they have every right to be angry at us for leaving the Qur'an. The story is this, a very quick story, and those of you who have heard me before, you know that I really enjoy this story. For the sake of my kids in the audience. There was a grandfather and a grandson. And the grandson did everything the grandfather did. For him, Dada was his superhero. He would dress like Dada, he would walk and talk like Dada, he would eat like Dada. He would stand like Dada. Everything Dada did, he did. And Dada was his whole world. And those of you who are grandfathers, I don't know, I really can't tell you, you might be able to relate to this. The grandfather had a very beautiful habit. Every single morning he would come down, he would sit at the breakfast table after breakfast, and open the Quran and read Arabic, just a page, and move on with his day. One day the grandson comes down and sees that his father, who's not an Arab by the way, is reading this page of the Quran in a very strange language, closes the book and puts it away. And this happens for a few days now. Until the grandson says, Dada, what are you reading? It's a Quran, it's an Arabic son, this and that. Do you know what you're reading? Do you know the Arabic language? No, I don't know the Arabic language. I know how to read it, but that's about it. He said, why are you reading a book like this? I don't understand. Would it not make sense for you to read a book in a language that you know, right? They're kids, but they'll ask questions that you and I think about, but these kids will ask those questions. And he knows that this grandson of mine is 8 years old. I can't give him the falsafa of Nuzul and Wahi, and no. So he takes him to the backyard. In the backyard, there was a wicker basket with coal inside of it. Coal. They used for the barbecue. Now, they lived on a very huge lot, and down the road was a local pond. He says to his grandson to take the basket, empty the coal out, go down to the pond, and get me some water in the wicker basket. Now, Dada said something, I have to do this. Dada, he's my superhero. Empties the basket, runs towards the pond, fills up the basket, and comes running back. Now, you know that wicker has a lot of holes inside of it. He comes running back, Dada, here's your water. Of course, the water is gone. It leaked all the way through the basket on the way back. There's no water inside the basket. He says, son, there's nothing in here. Go back and this time run faster and bring the water for me. He springs to the pond and he fills the basket. He runs back, Dada, here's your basket. And again, there's no water in it. And for a fourth time, he sends him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until this kid slams the basket down and says, you're making a fool out of me, Dada. This basket can't hold the water. He goes, you're right. So what was the point of this whole exercise, Dada? He said, look inside the basket. The basket from the coal was completely black on the inside. But as the water ran through the basket, the basket became completely red. He said, that's exactly the way the Quran is with our hearts. You're right, I'm not an Arab. Nobody here, I don't think, is an Arab. We don't understand everything that we recite. But as the meaning of the Quran falls through the holes of our hearts, in the process, it cleanses our heart to become better. There's absolute impact in reading just the Arabic. Just the Arabic. And part of the fact that we protect our Quran from tahrif, from distortion is the fact that we teach these small kids in our Sunday schools Alif Ba Ta. You ask a Jewish kid at the age of 7 or 8, he doesn't know Hebrew at all. He doesn't. Majority don't. But our kids, if they don't know anything, they know how to recite Arabic. So please, I'm with you. I will also carve out time. 5 verses a day. If you can do it as a family, that's even better. Sit around the table and have a Quran circle. You know, the month of Ramadan, we come, it's a beautiful atmosphere. The alim is here, the alim is here. It's a nice circle. Every kid, every alim is reading one verse at a time, or 2 verses. It's a beautiful environment. Why can't we emulate that inside of our homes? Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now on to the verse. The first starts off by talking about individuals. And we'll go as we did yesterday, break down the verse word for word, line by line. It starts off by saying, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa min al-nasi man ya'budu Allah ala harf. That from the men, from people, there are those who worship Allah ala harf. All of you with me, inshallah? Bismillah. Yes? Everybody here, inshallah, sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
I usually keep my most important discussions for the weekend. So you've shown up on Saturday, you've given me your Saturday nights, inshallah. Now I really need you to. This is now the height of our Khamsa Fire Day. It's a very important discussion. Especially for my sisters, inshallah, are listening. Inshallah. Starts off by saying, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَعْبُدُ اللَّهَ عَلَىٰ حَرْفٍ. From men there are those who worship Allah ala harf. Harf in Arabic means the edge of a cliff. And let me explain what that means before I move on with the verse. We live today in a very difficult time. In a time of confusion, in a time of doubt. You would not believe, or maybe you would believe, how much of our youth are fighting with the doubt of the deen. Things that perhaps as parents you might think is strong and untouchable inside of them is the very source of their doubts. It starts from the basic discussion of Tawheed. And everything else builds on that. If the base of Tawheed is shaky, the entire structure will be shaky. If the base of Tawheed is strong, you can build for as long as you want, it'll be a very strong builder. So the very first discussion that they always have with people like me is about Allah and God. Either His oneness or His uniqueness or why He created us or the idea of divine justice. And in this world right now where it seems like there are more domestic issues than before, our homes on a majority basis, there's a lot of stress inside of our homes. Our divorce rates are increasing inside of our community, unfortunately. The disconnect between the parent and the child seems to be increasing. Back in my parents' era, where of course we talked about at least 5, 6, 7 kids, at a time where they had no services, no water, no power, nothing, back in Karachi or Pakistan or India, it was at least 7, 8 kids. Now, after 2 kids, the parents say, I'm done. Right? And my mom always, you know, she laughs at us. She was, tum log ke paas himmat hi nahi hai, the way that we had himmat. Right? And she looks at me sometimes, I have 3 small kids, 2, 4, and 9. And at the end of the day, I'm done. And they go to bed at 7:30 in the evening. And when my mom calls, she goes, it sounds like you've been on a journey for 20 days. I go, I mean, this has been a very tough day. And she goes, I had 4 of you. And your baba was out all day. Anyway, so she laughed at us, and she still laughs at us today, anyways. So this idea, and we have hadith, by the way, that before the arrival of the Mahdi, there'll come a time where couples who have 6 kids will say that we wish we had 5. We wish we had 4. Those who have 1 child will say we wish we didn't have any children. And we live in a society now that puts price tags on kids. Right? That I refuse to have kids, number one, it's going to affect my body as a mother. Number two, it's too expensive. Right? And so this is the era that we live in. And so given all of that, there's a domestic issue going on. Lots of stress. And in this difficult sometimes economy, you need a double income family just to run the household. That means a child now doesn't have access to the parent for 8 to 9 hours a day. If you are a parent out there who has a father, or all of you are enough, where you are now provided for the family and the mother as a home, you should count your blessings. And thank Allah for that reason. Now, there are those couples who live outside their means, with all due respect, and they want that bigger house because their friends down the street have the bigger house, and so they'll put their child at the age of 2 in daycare for 10 hours, just so they can have a double income, so they can have, let's say, a 5,000 square foot house, in this market, of course. And so that's great. They have the house, mashallah, they have their maids, and they have, mashallah, beautiful homes and beautiful cars, but their children have no idea who they are. Their children call their nanny, the daycare woman, mommy, not the actual mother. And so the question is it worth it, right? That's a different discussion altogether. So we have issues inside. We have youth issues, major, I mean, a girl and a guy who fight to get married, fight the entire khandan to get married. Take on both khandans. Both khandans are not razi of the shadi, right? No, but daddy, I love him. Mommy, I love him. Finally, fine, nikah is done, this and that, they call me, I come, qadidtu. 6 months later, talaq happens. Same people who fought 2 years to get married, they couldn't have the sabr to handle the difficulty of first-year marriage. That's happening inside of our homes. We turn on the news, we see Yemen, we see Bahrain, we see Awamiya, we see Qatif, we see Syria, we see Pakistan, we see Iraq, we see Afghanistan, we see Burma. What don't we see? All of our brothers, either in faith or in madhab, being killed for no reason. And the prophecy and the hadith of the Holy Prophet, who said there'll come a time, Allah, where the one who kills has no idea why he's killing, and the one who's killed has no idea why he's being killed. You don't live in that era right now? These brainwashed soldiers of Daesh and ISIS? These monks in Burma who are doing this, that were Indian Muslims? You think they have any idea why they're doing this? You ask a 5-year-old why he's being beheaded in Burma? You ask a woman in Awamiya why her house is being burnt down? She has no idea. They're stopping buses for Pakistan, checking passports and killing you on the spot. If you ask him why, he has no idea. We live in this era now. We live in an era now. And the ulama have said flat out, this is the most oppressive time in the history of mankind. Now many of us will challenge that, but no, there's been blood shed before. And you're right, there's been world wars before. Absolutely. Nagasaki, Hiroshima is in front of us. But that's if you measure the amount of oppression by bodies that have been killed. It's not always bodies. There are two things ulama have said that are happening today that hasn't happened before. Number one is the severity of the oppression. The way that these people are carrying out these heinous acts has never before been seen. When ISIS first took over Mosul in Iraq, I mean, the story's coming out, the image is coming out. I don't know about you, but I've asked people, stop sending me this stuff on WhatsApp. I can't see these things. That we had individuals who were lining up the teenage boys in Iraq on the day of Eid, beheading them, video recording and sending that tape to their mothers when they are evil. This is heinous. Not never before done. So what is severity of the oppression? It's not so much about the amount of bodies, but how those bodies are being killed today. People are being burned alive. Young kids are being beheaded. Young kids are being, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be graphic. Number two is the reaction of those who witness the oppression. We become desensitized. Everything is social media. Everything is recorded and shared. Now, watching a video of this act no longer has an effect on us. But a beheading 10 years ago used to make front page news. Now it's buried on page 6. And this is why the oppression we have today is unlike anything else. The reason why I say this is because now that we have this entire issue inside the home, outside the home, within our families, within the ummah, this is a prime time for someone like Shaitan to come in and whisper inside the hearts of our youth and make them ask a question, where is your Allah now? Where's God in all this? How could God allow a Shia village like Awamiya in Saudi of 20,000 to be burnt to the ground? How could Allah allow the scholars and the poets and the academics of Pakistan be shot, killed in broad daylight and nothing happened? How could God allow it? How could God allow it? And if your iman is not strong, you'll say, yeah, you're right, Shaitan. How could God allow that? Yeah. And what ends up happening is one of two things. And the people begin to slowly detach themselves from Allah, which is happening on a very rapid rate right now. Or they're hanging on for dear life. They're barely keeping their iman above water. And as this ayat says, مَنْ يَعْبُدُ اللَّهَ عَلَىٰ حَفْ. They are worshipping Allah on the edge of a cliff. Their ayat says, on the edge of a cliff. One little nudge the wrong way and they're down. The ayat goes on to say, فَإِنْ أَسَابَاحُ الْخَيْرٌ اِتْمَعَنَّا بِهِ. So long as things are khair and good, there's itminan inside of their hearts. These are people who are right on the edge of the cliff. They could go either way. And I'm sure you have examples in your own personal life, people, and maybe you're like that as well. Maybe I don't know. But this is what the reality of today is. But then at the same time, فَإِنْ أَسَابَتْهُمْ فِتْنَةٌ إِنْقَلَبَ عَلَىٰ وَجْهِهِ. The ayah says, the moment that a fitna comes, fitna in Arabic means something different than Urdu. Urdu fitna means fasad, disruption, disunity, a problem. But fitna in the Quran means a test, a trial, a tribulation, a test. The moment a test comes, what they do, they إِنْقَلَبَ عَلَىٰ وَجْهِهِ. They turn their face away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That one little small test, it's like somebody on the edge of a cliff and someone doesn't have to give a grand push, if they simply nudge them a little bit, just nudge a little bit, they'll lose their footing and go down the cliff. It's interesting how in the first portion of the verse, it says when khair comes, when good comes, they're itminan, they're very sukoon, they're very serene, they're calm. And the opposite of that wasn't shar or evil, Allah uses fitna as the opposite of khair. Test as the opposite of good. Meaning whatever good comes is for your benefit, whatever does not come that's good is not bad or evil, it's a test for you. You have the power to convert that into good. These people who look at this like this, as long as good is happening, la ilaha illallah, I'll pray salat, I'll keep my fast, I'll give my homes, so long as everything is good. You've cured my mother, alhamdulillah, you've given me my job, mashallah. We have been trying for 3 years to have a child now. My wife is pregnant, alhamdulillah, everything is good. La ilaha illallah. Allah, you have even my khums up with you, mashallah. But the moment a little bit of fitna happens, the moment a little bit of a test happens, in qalba ala wajhihi, they turn their back against Allah. The ayah goes on to say, khasra dunya wal akhirah. They've lost the dunya, they've lost the akhirah. ذَلِكَ هُوَ الْخُسْرَانُ الْمُبِينُ. And the fact that you lose both worlds is the biggest loss. I mean, look, either you live in the dunya as your jannah or you wait for jannah akhirat, right? Either you sell one for the other or you purchase the other one. If you lose both worlds, ya Allah, that's a huge loss. What's left? Nothing's left. There are people, mashallah, who make this dunya their jannah. And they know full right that I'm going to get mine in the akhirat. Then there are those who sacrifice in this dunya with the hopes that whatever I'm sacrificing here, it's waiting for me in Jannah. And so there's a hope. The moment does not attach himself to the dunya, right? The moment does not sell his soul out for 60, 65 years of this dunya. He's waiting for what? Hum fiha khalidun, eternity inshallah. Huris, mashallah, and food and grapes and God knows, and milk and honey and everything. But a person who now loses both worlds. You see, it's amazing how when it comes to the loss, the word loss in the Quran either is khusr or khusran. Right? Wal asr inna al-insan lafi khusr. Man is at loss. What's khusran? Khusran is a huge loss. It's called sighay mubalagha in the world of Arabic. For example, sajda, sajid, sajjad. Is there a difference? There's a big difference. Sajda, prostration. Sajid, one who does sajda. Sajjad, one who does sajda a lot. Imam Sajjad is known as Sajjad Lai. He was constantly in sujood. Khusr is loss. Khusran is a huge loss. Nothing bigger of a loss than this. Can it be that we could, if we lose both worlds, na'udhu billah, is there anything bigger of a loss? No, there isn't. If I know that my akhirat is going to be a problem, then I make my dunya heaven. It's like, you know, my father marhum used to tell us when we were young, you want to go on a Friday, go out, but be home by 11 p.m. That's your curfew. And he meant it. If you knew my father, he meant it. And now, you know, you're having, you know, a good time, you know, halal fun, don't worry, halal fun, everything halal. And you notice the time is 11:30. Like, oh my God, it's 11:30. I'm still a good 20 minutes away from home. And then you think to yourself, now Shaitan comes like, you're already late, as it is. Just spend an extra couple of hours, enjoy your time, and then get your punishment when you get home. 11:30 or 2:30 is the same punishment. Enjoy your moment now, get yours later. Enjoy the dunya now, get yours in the akhirah. Or, you know what? Get your punishment here and expect there. But now you're losing both. Khusran al-mubin. It's an azeem loss. Why is it a loss? Let's extend that. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
It is a common discussion on the minbar to talk about the trials of this dunya. It's always a good reminder for us to understand the wisdom and the hikmah behind sometimes Allah's plan. And here's the problem, and not a problem, I mean, here is the reality. We have in Surah Al-Baqarah, Alif Lam Mim, ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابَ الْعَرِيبَ فِي هُدَلِّ الْمُتَّقِينَ الَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ أَحْسَنَ. The very first quality, sifat of those who are the muttaqeen, are what? They believe in the unseen. Now the unseen ahadith and tafsir have said that it could mean Imam Zamana, it could mean Allah himself, but also what's unseen for us, and please follow me here, what's unseen for us is Allah's plan as well. We have no idea what he has in store for us. Right? A lot of our youth, they question us that, you know, what's the point of me going through this entire emotion of life when Allah knows where I'll end up? He knows. I said, he knows, but you don't know where you'll end up. It's for you. I mean, I don't know about all of you, but I don't get a memo telling me, look, Asad, you're going through some problems now, but next Friday, there'll be ease coming for you. Your mother was diagnosed with cancer, Godfrey, but don't worry about it, she will get cured, but it'll take her 6 months. You just lost your job, but in about 8 weeks, you'll get a better job in a better company. Just make sure right now you hold on to your iman. You just got married, you're looking to have a child. Don't worry, in about 2 years, I'll give you a child. I don't get a memo like that. I'm sure none of you do here. If you do, mashallah, you're one of the pious ones. Allah does not make his plan known to us. And it's not a cruel way that it's not that he's torturing or punishing us. But part of the idea of taslim and mutlaq, absolute submission, is to trust the plan of Allah as well. He has a plan. And he has a plan based on love. Part of the discussion yesterday, these are all connected by the way, is that I tried to establish the love of Allah with that story of Nabi Musa and the rain. That how much does Allah love us? How much has Allah covered us? The stuff that we've done behind closed doors that nobody knows, and yet when we walk through that door, we have the respect of the entire community. When you know in the heart of your heart, or I know at least, I don't deserve that respect. That if you saw me behind closed doors, you would not even say salam to me, as Hadith Qudsi says. But yet Allah, time and time again, maintains that respect, protect, even elevates that respect in certain moments. How can we expect that his plan is this torturous plan? It's not, it can't be. But yeah, there's an element of the fact that Allah, look, I know that right now things are tough. I don't know where this road is headed, but I do know that I have trust in you. I'm putting it in your hand. You fix it now. I'll sit back and I will have complete reliance on you. And that's the old and the extreme of patience. I'll share with you one beautiful hadith by Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam. Those of you in this room and my sisters and mothers who are listening to me over there, I know that as many people as there are in this room, there are that many stories of struggle in this room as well. Everyone here is going through something. There's not a person right now who is, you know what, I'm problem free. Something is bothering you at night. And sometimes it takes our sleep away and our hope away and replace that with depression, anxiety, even thoughts of suicide, God forbid. And sometimes we handle it. But the dunya throws at us, and throws at us, and throws at us. And we dodge, We hurdle, we leap over, we go around, we take the hit, we move on. That's the reality of this dunya. I don't mean to be Mr. Bad News, but nobody ever sent you a text saying, oh, by the way, the dunya is a great place to live in. A problem-free, stress-free life. You're a mu'min, you're a believer, don't worry, you won't be touched in the dunya. No, you'll be tested just like everybody else will. We've been reminded by the Ahlul Bayt, by the Quran, and even with our experience, that this dunya is two things, distraction and test. And the test doesn't stop. You know, my elders in the audience, you can look back to your teenage years, in your 20s, and those issues that back then will make you lose sleep when you were a young, single guy, free, azad, mashallah. Seems like a long time ago, right? And those things that kept you up at night, and now you laugh at those things, do you know? You think, oh, I wish I was 20 again. I wish I was 24 again. I wish I had those problems back then. Those things were easy. But you ask a 24-year-old everything right now is, that's it, this is the end all and be all. You ask a 24 when he was 15, what would keep him up at night? Oh, that's nothing now compared to, and that's the cycle of this dunya. Even as you get older, you might not worry about union, you're worried about your kids, and their iman, and their future, and in the West. It's constant parashani, constant stress. And some handle it, some don't. But nobody ever promised any of us a life that's problem-free and stress-free. And so I ask you, those of you who are dealing with your problems, say, please, this hadith is a ray of hope from our imam, our sixth imam. He says, "Inna subbirun." Please follow very carefully. We are very patient. Who's we? The Ahlul Bayt. We, the Ahlul Bayt, are very patient. Subbirun, again, sabr, sabir, subbir. Sighe mubalighah. Patient, then very patient. Khusr, khusran, sajda, sajjad. Right? These are all Arabic classes, by the way. Free of charge. Inna subbirun, we're very patient. Wa shi'atuna asbaru minna. Oh my God. Our Shias, though, are more patient than we are. Yeah, it's hard to digest. He's saying this in the presence of many of his ashab. And just like you would have asked if I was there, and thank God for these righteous, pious sahabis for asking these questions for us, one person said, how could it be, Yabna Rasulullah, that we are more patient than you? Your history is in front of us. What you've gone through is in front of us. And I'm not trying to say, and I read this hadith somewhere in the US and I got in a lot of trouble. And someone came to me and said, are you trying to say that what I am going through is more than what Hussein went through the day of Ashura? No, of course not. That's not what I'm saying. This companion asked Imam Saleh, and please listen to the answer very carefully. He says, how could you claim that the Shias are more patient than you are? He says this, Nasburu ala ma na'alamu. وَشِيَعَتُنَا يَسْأُرُنَا عَلَى مَا لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. We are patient based on our knowledge.
Subhanallah. Subhanallah.
We know that our patience now will result in this down the road. But our Shias are patient despite the fact they don't have the knowledge what will happen after patience. They don't know what's going to happen afterwards. They're asked to be patient, and patient in the ghaib, in the unseen. And so you're patient. Fine, Allah, you asking your patient. It's killing me to know what will happen to me 1 year from now. There are mothers who have daughters at home who are in their mid-20s, late-20s, and they're waiting for that door to ring, and that phone to ring, and that damad to come through, and that rishta to come through. Her cousins are married, her friends are married, everyone in the community is married. She's not married yet. And the older she gets, for some reason, that window begins to close. And now the mother is stressed. And wherever she goes, what do we do? What do I do? What do I do? Be patient. And she goes, fine, I'll be patient. But she has no idea. Will I get a rishta tomorrow for my daughter or a year from now? She doesn't know. But she's right. She's patient. She's patient. You, God forbid, get a diagnosis of an illness that's very terminal. And you go home, and that drive home from the doctor has 1,000 thoughts in your mind. That if the worst case happens, what happens to my kids, to my wife, to this, to that, get my will ready, you know, let my parents know, a thousand, you have no idea what's going to happen, you're told to be patient. You're told to be patient. Imam Sadi says that patience is better than our patience. Can you imagine? Can you imagine our sixth Imam is telling us that, look, I get it. We get what you're going through. That's the message of the hadith, right? Again, I'll bring it home for my personal story. My father, marhum, wasn't a very affectionate man. Like most of their fathers, he wasn't a hugger, a kisser, or a way to go, son. He was like that. So I got a handshake once in a while, that was a big deal. Wasn't a very emotional man, wasn't a sensitive man. I'm not saying he was upset, but he wasn't. I mean, that's just how he was raised. Until I remember one conversation, this happened at least 20 years ago. I graduated from high school in Toronto, in the East, in Markham. I got my diploma. He looked at it, he shook my hand, he says, congratulations. And that was it. And my mom, you know, she'd bring the lendu, my tie, and go to the everything, okay? But him, congratulations. And then we were on our way to Al Mahdi Center one day. We would often go on Shalai Jummah, me and him alone. And there's moments where I could tell, okay, my father, you know, he's in a good soft mood. I can say things to him that I couldn't say normally. So I found myself driving with him in the car, and he was in one of those moods. I said, let me just say something to him. Buddy, he must say. I said, Dad, do you know how difficult it is to spend 4 years of high school here in the West? Do you know how hard it is to graduate from high school? And then his face got serious. I said, oh, my. I'm in trouble now. But he says something to me. I'll never forget that ride to Al Mahdi Center. He says that, you don't think I understand? That you spent 4 years, and back then it was, you know, OAC, 5 years in high school. Now it's 4 years. 5 years in high school, and he was dead serious. And you spent those 5 years without being an alcoholic, without being a drug addict, without being a father, without being a jailmate, completely clean. You don't smoke. You don't do anything. You don't do drugs. You don't take steroids. Everything back then, which is very, very normal. He goes, you don't think that piece of paper means nothing to me? The fact that you came out of those 5 years with your iman and faith intact to a certain degree without all these things meant more to me than a piece of paper. Meaning that conversation to me was the fact that my father said, I get it, Asad. I understand what you went through. And he said that what you guys go through here in the West, we never went through back in Pakistan and correction. We had our own challenges, but not the challenges you guys have here. And for that moment, I felt, wow, that was better for me than any hug, any handshake, any shabash he could ever give me. Because he tells me that, look, I know your struggle is real, your patience is real, and I get it. Imam Sadiq is saying your patience is better than ours. Because you don't have the ilm-ghayb that we have. You don't know the result of our patience will be this. You are asking yourself to trust Allah's plan. And when you are patient, you're absolutely saying, La ilaha illallah. That's the oath of taslim. I submit to you, Allah. I don't know what happened to my mother, or my job, or my daughter. She's 28 now. But I'm patient. I'm patient. I won't lose the musalla. I won't become a kafir or munafiq. I will continue to worship you and love the Ahlul Bayt and send salawat on Ali Muhammad, but I won't leave your side. I trust your plan completely. That patience is better than the patience of Ali Muhammad. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
But we can't get to that level if we're on the edge of the cliff. Because all we see is down. That's all we see. It's almost like, you know, you come home from a very long day at work sometimes, and everybody at work upset you. Everybody at work. And you come home and you're fuming mad, and you think, you know, if somebody says one more thing to me, I'm going to pop. And you come home, and your wife says, oh, salam, how was your day? Don't, and you pop. Oh, she said, salam, how are you? That person is on the edge of the cliff. A little bit of the dunya blows at them, and they're gone. They're down. Ala harf in the Quran says. These are people who worship Allah on the edge of a cliff. As long as khair, 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 Allah, Allah, Allah. Fitna happens, Allah, how could you? How dare you? And nifaq comes out of our mouth. Kufr comes out of our mouth. shit comes out of our mouth. How could you take my father from me? How could you give my wife cancer? How could you take my Jalan son? I did this for you, I did that for you, I did this for you. And all these ahsans come out onto Allah. That you owe me this, you owe me that, you owe me this, you owe me that. And we expect from this dunya what it can't give us. A man comes to Imam Ali, he complains about his state. My wealth, Mawla, my health, Mawla, my wife, Mawla, my kids, Mawla. Everything is going down, 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 down. Imam Ali says, I'll pray for you. I'll pray for you. I'll pray for you. A few days later, he goes back to Imam Ali. By the way, Mawla, your duas didn't work. Those problems still exist, and I have more now. 1, 2, 3, now we're out of the past few days. And again, he starts to complain, and complain, and complain. Imam Ali now becomes upset, the Ali says. That you were expecting from the dunya what it can't give you. You want sukoon itminan. This dunya is not for sukoon itminan. Instead of praying, Allah, instead of asking for a problem-free life, ask Allah that while I go through my problems, my iman remains intact.
SubhanAllah. SubhanAllah. SubhanAllah.
Because where we lose our iman is where things get a little bit rocky in our life. That's when the true test comes. That's when the true fitna comes in the Quranic tense. The true test comes. And we are stuck on, oh, Allah is picking on me. He's targeting me. Because we believe everybody else has a beautiful life. Allah has it out for me. For some reason, He likes to see me suffer, God forbid. Whereas Allah says, مَا يَفْعَلُ اللَّهُ بِعَذَابِكُمْ What will I gain from punishing you? You think I get happy in punishing you? You think I want to punish you? You think this entire test is torture for you? And I am just sitting there evilly laughing up there in the heavens. Ha ha, look at this man going through his torture. God forbid, is that the image we have of Allah? No, it's not. And let me give you two examples and move on from this. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ala.
The example is Nabi Musa's mother and Nabi Yaqub's son. Or Nabi Musa's mother and Nabi Yaqub himself. Both of them lost their child. Nabi Musa's mother put Musa in a basket, went down the river. Nabi Yaqub lost Yusuf for many, many years. Nabi Musa's mother was reunited with her son hours after losing him. The Hadith says the moment that Musa needed to be fed again, he didn't take anyone else's milk but his own mother's. And they were reunited within hours after losing each other. Nabi Yaqub did not see his son until years after he lost him. So yeah, there are moments where Allah answers our du'as and our trials immediately. Then there are moments where there's a delayed response. But look at the story of Nabi Yusuf very, very quickly. All you know the idea. He went from a well to a slave. He ended up in Egypt, in jail. All this story, of course, is in front of you. When he was in jail, when Nabi Yusuf was in jail, he was asked to do what? He was asked to interpret a dream of the king of the time. And the king liked his interpretation so well that he brought him on board as part of his government. He says, look, right now these 7 years will be very successful in your economy. But there'll come a time 7 years from now where your people will suffer. If you don't make the proper provisions now and save now, you're going to run into famine and death and war 7 years from now. And then he says to him that I'm the only one who can take on this task to make sure 7 years from now your people don't suffer. That's exactly what happened. The king made him the head of treasury. As you know, it was the only area in that land during that time that was able to what? Provide its people with food and water. Otherwise, we're talking about, like I said, malnutrition, famine, hunger, death. And so on one side you have Nabi Yaqub, the Quran says, cried until the whiteness of his eyes left for Yusuf. You think, wow, that's torturous. 18, 19 years, some say, he cried for Yusuf, cried for Yusuf, cried for Yusuf. But the one cry of Nabi Yaqub, the one cry, saved the cry of hundreds of fathers who would have cried for their son who would lose their life due to famine and hunger. Sometimes it's the case, and this takes a very broad mind to understand this and to digest it. Sometimes our tribulation is a sadaqah for somebody else. Sometimes we inspire others through our trial. You know, when I lost my father 15 years ago, I was in my late 20s. And as devastating as it was to lose my father, I would look to somebody in the same community who lost her father at the age of 9 or 10. And what would bring me tasalli and comfort was that I'm in my late 20s. I have other siblings. I have an older brother. I have a younger brother. This brother is at the age of 10 years old. He's the only man now in his house. He's asked now to be a man overnight. Meaning his tribulation, his trial was a path of comfort and motivation for someone like me. But he has no idea that he did that for me. Meanwhile, he could be at home complaining, God, how could you take my father away from me when I was 10 years old? How could you? Meanwhile, people like me and others will look at him as a source of inspiration. And perhaps my tears were dry thinking that, what? At least I'm not a 10-year-old right now struggling without my father. So yes, there are moments where your trial, your story, your defiance, your resistance, your courage is a path for somebody else. Just like Yaqub's tears saved hundreds of fathers from crying for the lost children. If Yusuf was beside Yaqub, he wouldn't be in the jail. If Yusuf was beside Yaqub, he would not be the head of treasury. And hundreds of fathers would have lost their kids. Yaqub would stop crying, but hundreds would start crying. We need that vision when it comes to our trials and tribulations, but we can't do it if we're at the edge of the cliff. We can't do it if we're at the edge of the cliff. Now, one last point about this verse. What does Allah mean that I'll lose the dunya and the akhirah? It's a very important point to understand. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. Quickly, stay with me. I think I'm losing some of you. You guys are all with me, inshallah? Okay. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Trials, tribulations, tests, hardships, struggles, difficulties in this world are not prejudice. They don't look at you and look at the color of your skin and where you're from and what your aqidah is and what your belief is and say, oh, okay, because you're this, I'm going to give you a hardship. Your white neighbor beside you, your black neighbor across the street, your Hindu guy on this side, all of them have their fair share of struggles. If you lost your job, maybe the guy in front of you also lost his job. If, God forbid, your neighbor lost his mother to cancer, you did as well. For example, I'm saying. And so hardships have no prejudice. Hardships are the reality of this dunya. Whoever lives in this dunya has to face these struggles and hardships. Okay, this point is very, very important. Please follow me. This is that portion of the ayah that says, "What khusr al-dunya wal-akhirah?" They've lost the dunya, they've lost the akhirah. Who? Those who are on the edge of the cliff. Keep that in mind. Now you have this idea that you have yourself, and you have, let's say, your neighbor Bob. And both are going through the exact same tribulation. Bob's an atheist, you're a mu'min. And oftentimes I wonder to myself that those people who have no one to believe in, where do they go when this dunya gets the best of them? What did they do? How do they find comfort? Who do they cry to? Where is their outlet? Where is that avenue of salvation? We have several. One is this mashallah. People come and they dump their tragedy in the ocean of Hussein. They feel better. Not in a cruel way, but that's part of the beauty nature of Imam Hussein. Is that, yes, no doubt, we go through our tragedy, but there is no deal like Hussein's. We take our tragedy, our drop, and we drop in the ocean of Hussein. We cry for Ali Akbar. We cry, let's say, for Imam Sajjad. At the same time, we cry for our loved ones as well. That's the beauty of it. I mean, we are thankful for that. But if you're an atheist, agnostic, you have no belief in any sort of power, where do you go? When the Quran says, وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ لَا يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا, that if you have taqwa, will give you an outlet, a makhraj, an exit for your problems, if you have taqwa. Those who don't have taqwa, don't have Allah, where do they go? I have no idea. I don't know. I legit don't know where they go. So now, you both of you are facing the exact same problem. You go towards the mahal and musalla, and he just festers in his problems. And the number one selling drug in this Western North America is Prozac. It's an antidepressant pill. This mental health awareness idea is booming in the West. Why? Because people are drowning in their own anxiety, in their own depression. Suicide rates amongst the youth are skyrocketing because they don't know how to handle their problems. They're expecting heaven on this earth, and they're not getting it. And we equally have problems just like they do, but we turn towards Allah. We go to the musalla, we go to the mahram, we have du'as upon du'as, so we ahlamit for any problem that you have. Open up Saif al-Sajadiyah, it's all right there, a huge remedy. Not only do the Ahl al-Bayt tell us when to ask and who to ask, but how to ask as well. Just read this du'a, that's it. We'll give you the alfaz and we'll give you the words, just read it. Now if you don't have that, where do you go? So now can you imagine, the verse says, the moment the test comes, they do what? Inqalaba ala wajhihi. They turn their face away from Allah, meaning what? Now the atheist is on this side, and you also are on this side as well. Because now you've turned your face against Allah. Now you and your problem are alone. You're dealing with your issue alone. Allah no longer is in the picture, you've turned your face away from Allah. Now where do you go? You're equally alone as that person is alone. You've lost your dunya, you've lost your akhirat as well. Because you've turned your face away from that one Allah that says, look, when the test happens, come running towards me. Don't run away from me.
Subhanallah.
Because part of the issue of a test is Allah knows. Without a fitna inside of our life, we are very ghafil and forgetful human beings. Things are going smooth, we forget Allah. The moment things get a little bit rocky, Allah, Allah, tasbih, ta'biz, dua. And these WhatsApp messages, read this 40 times, read this 10 times, everything will be cured, inshallah. That's how Allah knows. Like, let me just put a crack in his sidewalk, make him trip to remind him that I'm still here. I'm still here. Now, if at that moment we turn our face away from Allah, our dunya is gone and our akhirat is gone as well. ذَلِكَ هُوَ الْخُسْرَانُ الْمُبِينُ. This is the ultimate loss for the human being. صَلُّ عَلَى مُحَمَّدُ وَعَلَى مُحَمَّدُ
صَلَّى
اللَّهُ عَلَيْكَ يَا أَبَا عَبْدِ اللَّهِ السلام عليك يا مظلوم The days of suffer continue and inshallah I believe tomorrow night is the shab of the shahadat of Bibi Sakina and we'll give her her doom aside tomorrow night inshallah The days of Arba'een are approaching Karbala is filling in front of our eyes. Some of the mu'mineen who had the tawfiq and the invitation to go to Karbala, many have already left from here. The numbers are coming out of Iraq. There's millions upon millions who are going towards Karbala. Images that you've seen almost every single year, even people who are walking from miles and miles away. Sometimes those who can't walk, they have their own wheelchairs, their own crutches. I've seen images of individuals with one leg slowly but surely making their way towards Karbala. I've seen sons carry their mothers in a wheelchair, push their wheelchair towards Karbala. I've seen one image of a man who had no legs, pushing himself with his arms towards Karbala. And the hadith said, Imam Sadiq says that may Allah have mercy on the cheeks that rub themselves against the dhari of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn. And all of this, of course, was a prophecy by Imam Husayn. When he arrived in Karbala, the second of Muharram, and he addresses the Bani Yasir tribe. And for those of you who plan to go to Karbala this year, please listen to this very carefully. He first goes to the men of the Bani Yasir tribe. It's a very ajeeb conversation. He says that, look, there's going to be a battle here. Our blood will be shed, our lives will be lost, we'll be killed in the most brutalist way. If you can collectively, please bury our bodies for us. He then puts up a partition, Imam Hussein does, and talks to the women of the Bani Yasir tribe, and says to them, look, if your men and your husbands and your sons are not able to bury us, then you as women, I know you can't bear us one by one, just dig a massive grave and simply place our bodies inside that grave. And then he goes to the kids of the Bani Yasir tribe. He picks up the children, he kisses them, he hugs them, he puts them on the lap. He says, are you Muslim? Yes, we're Muslim. Do you recite the kalama? Yes, we do. That Muhammad that you recited the kalama, he's my grandfather. My name is Hussein. Yes, we know who you are. If your fathers are not able to bury us, you with your masum hands, simply pick up the khak of Karbala and drop it on our bodies. And then he says something very beautiful, Imam Hussein does, to the Bani Yasir tribe men. He said, look, there'll come a time where our zaris will be built here. And our shields from far and wide will come to send their salams to us. If you see any of them coming from far and wide, tell them that their Aqa Hussein sends his salams to them. I mean, those of you who have gone to Karbala, and those of you who will go to Karbala, know that when you stand there in front of the Dari of Imam Hussein and send your salams, As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah, from that headless body the jawab comes, alaykum salam. He's promised this. 25, 26, 28 million crawling, pushing, running towards Hussein. All of this, of course, came with a price. Then when they asked Imam Sajjad, Imam said, well, how much longer will you cry, Ya Rasulullah? It's been 33 years since the day of Ashura. You cry tears of blood. Whenever you pass by somebody who's sacrificing an animal, you ask them, did you give this animal water? Yes, Ya Rasulullah, we never sacrifice an animal without giving him some water. He begins to cry that my father Hussein was sacrificed on the day of Ashura to the point where the Zuljanah went back to the Khaymah. Sakina comes running out. Hey Zuljanah, my Baba, tell me, when they zibat my father, did they give him a drop of water? They would say that this is your fakhr, this is your pride. Shahadat is part of your khandan. And he would say, yes, you're right. I have no problem with those who are shaheed. But tell me, taking our women as prisoners, parading them up and down the Bazaar of Sham, is that our pride? Is that our khandan? No, it's not. This Ahl-e Haram entered the bazaar. People were throwing rocks at the women. People were shouting upset at the women. There came a moment where Sakina turns to Zainab and says, then if you can find me a drop of water, I'm very thirsty. A woman who is witnessing this goes, runs inside, grabs a glass of water, comes running to Zainab and says, here you go, here's a water for your small little daughter. And Zainab says, in this ghurbat, in this bazaar isham, this person is showing us a little bit of love. Who are you? Where are you from? She says, I live right here in Sham, but I cannot bardash the sound of Al-Ataj, Al-Ataj. And she gives the water to Sakina, and then she says to Sakina that after you're done drinking the water, I have two hajjad if you don't mind. I've heard that the du'as of a yatim are qabool very fast in the kingdom of Allah. And Bibi Zainab says, Sakina, before you drink the water, simply ask her for a hajjad. The books say that it felt like the woman had forgotten her first dua when she saw the state of Sakina in front of her. There in front of her was a four-year-old Sakina with bruises on her cheeks, blood dripping from her ears, a burnt kurta, and all she said was, my first hajjad is this to you, oh four-year-old. I also have small kids at home. May Allah not make them yatim like Allah has made you yatim. I don't know how Sakina did it, but she raised her masum hands up to the heavens. Ey Allah, for the sake of my own yatimiyat, please don't make her children yatim like me. What's your second dua, oh my lady? The second dua I have is somehow take me back to Medina. Zainab hears Medina and says, who do you know in Medina? She says, in Medina, I serve the house of Rasulullah. I serve the house of my Aqa Ali. I lived with my Shahzadi Zainab. Bibi Zainab says that if you saw Zainab standing in front of you today, could you recognize her? She says, yes, I could. She was my Shahzadi. She was my everything. Bibi Zainab recognized her. She said, hey, Ummay Habiba, this is your Zainab, the head of the Lokaneza. That's your Aqa Hussein. فيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون إنا لله وإنا إليه راجعون. مع الدنيا حسين.